Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Kristen Esperlon reports on air quality issues at Mammoth Cave National Park. First, the stock market is fluctuating, unemployment is rising, cuts are coming for state and local governments. But as Gabe Bullard reports, some Louisville businesses are thriving in the downturn.
At the Sassy Fox, Jessica Moreland is busy.
I've just noticed, you know, a lot more business than we normally have. A lot of new faces, people that, you know, haven't been shopping here before.
The Sassy Fox is Moreland's consignment shop. It sells previously owned women's clothes. Moreland says business was always steady, but now there's even more.
I think a lot of it has to do with the economy right now. I think people are looking for still nice clothes, but, you know, looking to spend a little bit less money.
Moreland says more women are coming in to sell fine jewelry, too, or even trade it for clothes. A few miles from Sassy Fox, Kevin Roppel has seen more customers looking to save money, too. He's a car mechanic.
We're seeing more and more people hang on to their cars, having to hang on to their cars, and having the service work done instead of trading them in on a new vehicle.
Roppel is co-owner of Roppel Industries, and like Moreland, he's seen customers give up some luxuries.
The audio side of it, the tinted windows, the exterior. If you have an accident and it's a minor one and you get paid from the insurance company a certain amount of money to go have your car repaired, and if it's still drivable, who cares what it looks like, I'm going to keep the money and put it in my budget.
People want to keep their cars as long as possible. It's going to have the strange effect of taking away a large chunk of the used car market, which will probably drive up the price of whatever used cars are actually out there for sale.
Dr. David Dabowski teaches finance at the University of Louisville. He says car parts and used clothing aren't the only goods selling well right now.
Campbell Soup is doing very well this year. Maybe one of the best performing stocks in the entire market is Anheuser-Busch, and which makes sense that people want relatively inexpensive sources of intoxication.
Dabowski says the shift in demand Campbell's, Busch, Roppel, and Moreland have seen is common in lean economic years, and a long recession will mean more people want more value out of what they already have. But there is an upside. Again, David Dabowski.
It's quite possible that after 2 or 3 or 5 years of living leaner, maybe Americans will actually have learned to live leaner and save more and spend less.
More savings means less borrowing, and too many people borrowing too much was one of the catalysts of the current financial meltdown. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
The skies over Mammoth Cave National Park are already so hazy it's hard to see more than a few miles. Now a confusing whirl of pending regulations and lawsuits is putting the future of air quality in all national parks at stake. Kristen Esperlon reports.
On the outer edge of the forest, Mammoth Cave National Park's air quality manager, Bob Carson, shows off an elaborate monitoring station. In this fenced-off clearing, two humble-looking sheds house super-sensitive pollution detectors. One keeps tabs on how much soot or particulate matter is in the air. Carson says the instruments tell him not only how much particulate matter is in the air, but what's in that matter.
Today is a sampling day. We measure particulate matter in the air one in 3 days. So every 3 days, we get a 24-hour sample.
Mammoth Cave has some of the worst air quality and worst visibility of any national park in the country. Some 40 coal-fired power plants operate within 200 miles of the park. These plants not only put out soot, but greenhouse gases and the neurotoxin mercury. Carson says it's the soot that makes skies so hazy over the park, especially in summer. A camera snaps shots over the park every day, and Carson can see just how the haze blurs tree-lined ridges, washes out colors. In the other shed, he explains how we know this soot creates the haze problem. These particles scatter light.
We use this device to measure the particles that are scattering light, and we use that number to calculate our visual range in miles.
Carson says visibility hasn't gotten any worse or really any better over the past several years, but one attempt to improve it for all national parks came from the 1999 Hays Rule. Bruce Polkowski is with the National Park Service's Air Resources Division. He helped write the rule.
It established a long-term goal to return these designated areas to quote-unquote natural conditions.
Polkowski says the Hays Rule instructed states to make sure older power plants installed the best available technology to control their emissions. And every 10 years, states have to assess their progress and file a plan to maintain it with the EPA. The first round of those plans are due now, but Polkowski says there's a holdup, another rule that throws the Hays Rule into question. It's the Clean Air Interstate Rule, or CARE. The idea behind CARE was to tackle pollution as a regional problem. If states joined the program, they had to reduce overall emissions from utilities, not individual plants. Again, Bruce Polkowski.
What the Clean Air Interstate Rule said, well, we're doing such a massive reduction across the whole utility sector that we're just going to go ahead and say, if your state implements the Clean Air Interstate Rule, you, state, do not have to address best available retrofit technology for your utility sector.
In other words, the Clean Air Interstate Rule trumped the Hays Rule. If you join CARE, you don't have to retrofit old plants. That is, until a judge threw CARE out.
Most of the southeastern states have already adopted their regulations, assuming that, you know, because they joined CARE, their utilities are fine. They didn't have to go back and look at who was built when and what their control technologies are. They just said, we're part of CARE, we're done. Now, that's all in question.
With the Clean Air Interstate Rule up in the air, states and parks are in a holding pattern with air quality plans. No one knows whether CARE could be reinstated. With all the uncertainty, many states are lagging behind on turning in their haze plans. And the National Parks Conservation Association has sued the EPA over the stragglers. Spokesman Mark Wensler says they want to make sure states move forward regardless of the regulatory limbo. He says Kentucky's plan has been submitted. Now it needs to be implemented.
There's a huge impact in Mammoth Cave. It's one of the most polluted parks in the country. And so what we're really looking to do is speed up the process of starting to clean up the worst offenders around Mammoth Cave to restore clean air to the park.
But even the Hays Rule, Wensler hopes states will take action on, could be called into question, too. The Washington Post just reported that the EPA is close to changing it. Some fear the change could weaken protections for air quality in parks that are already suffering. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Sure, the end of the year holidays have significant meaning for different faiths, but this time is also when arts organizations take stock of their current season and plan for the next. Elizabeth Kramer reports on how the current economy is factoring into what we might see and hear in the future.
Summer's high fuel costs and the economy now on the skids means holiday spending will be less lavish this year for many Louisville families. That includes the Glissons, says mother of three, Amy Glisson.
It's going to be very tight. Having done a lot of things this summer with the gas being so high, we overdid it, so now we're just trying to lay back a little bit.
That sentiment has city arts organizations paying close attention to how people are spending their money, including the Louisville Ballet. In the studio, dancers are furiously rehearsing the final scene of The Nutcracker for this year's run that opens next week. Ticket sales for this production are key to the company's survival.
Nutcracker is 25% of our annual budget. $3.5 million budget, 25% of that hits in about 10 days in December.
Jack Lemon is the company's executive director. So far, the ballet has sold 40% of the tickets it needs to sell. While Lemon says it's too early to tell if the economy is affecting Nutcracker sales, he says sales for performances in early October were off.
I could feel tickets sagging. That was the week the stock market kind of went. Our ticket sales didn't do quite as well as I would have thought.
Actors Theatre of Louisville is hitting its ticket sales goals for holiday shows. They're 29% of the season's total ticket sales. Attendance of the Speed Art Museum's current exhibit of historic American art was less than expected, causing the museum to lower its prices. Over at the Fraser International History Museum, revenue from attendance makes up 20% of the budget, and in the past few months, it has fallen about 2%. Museum Executive Director Madeline Burnside.
We could easily lose 5% of our income there. I'm hoping it's not that drastic.
The museum has a hiring freeze, and Burnside and staff are planning future exhibits that are inexpensive to produce.
You've got to prepare for the worst and fight for the best.
People who advise arts organizations say be conservative when planning. Teresa Ehring heads the Theater Communications Group and its 460-member theaters, including Actors Theater.
This would be a time to be thinking about really how bad could it get and how would we function if that worst-case scenario came to be reality.
Actors Managing Director Jennifer Bielstein says the theater doesn't plan on scaling back on any current season productions, but it's gone through its budget and deferred some capital expenditures.
We are budgeted so tightly. Every dollar is accounted for where it's to be spent. And with our planning cycle of committing to a season a year to a year and a half in advance, it's hard to make those short-term reactionary adjustments when funding sources decrease.
Arts leaders are now planning for next season, and that is where they are looking to scale down costs. Actors Theater and the Broadway series are considering fewer shows. The Louisville Ballet, the Louisville Orchestra, and the Kentucky Opera plan to announce their seasons early to be the first in line for people's entertainment budgets. Most organizations are trying to avoid lowering ticket prices, but leaders say if people's discretionary income falls further, they may have to do just that. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Last month, the Board of Waterworks approved a 5.5% rate increase for the Louisville Water Company. The water company increases its rates every year, but this year customer complaints were more frequent than usual. On Monday, the Metro Council's Transportation and Public Works Committee will investigate the rate increase. Gabe Bullard spoke with that committee's co-chair, Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh.
Has this happened before? Has an increase that's been approved by the Board of Waterworks come to the council?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure if it has come before the Metro Council or the Board of Aldermen previously. I'm sorry, I don't know that, but that really is part of the line of questioning that we intend to bring before my committee on Monday. Those questions like, what is the enabling legislation that allows you to increase the cost for your service, you know, for water? What triggers that? Is there a certain margin that you can automatically increase it without approval? Some of those kinds of questions that we really don't know in detail that causes the, you know, in how the Louisville Water Company operates. So part of what we're, you know, just like with MSD, when we were looking at their increases, they are able to increase up to a certain percentage, but once it's over that 7%, it comes before Metro Council for approval. So those are some of the kinds of procedural questions that my committee members and I will be asking.
And which committee is this?
It's the Transportation and Public Works Committee of the Metro Council.
Why the decision to take up this water rate increase, since they've increased their rates every year prior?
Well, I think that it, at least on two levels, one which is obvious, our economy and the ill effects it's having in all kinds of ways on our citizenry. Just people more and more are cutting back and trying to do their part, and people are even taking, you know, pay decreases and furloughs as we are here to make those adjustments. But it seems like a 5.5% rate increase, though it's the lower end of what they recommended, I think up to a 6.5%, still seems like a pretty good jump. And so we're trying to figure out really, is, you know, do we have to do that all right now? Is there a way to ease into that? You know, what is it that we're trying to accomplish by it being 5.5? Can we, you know, can we get by with, can you get by with a 2.5 perhaps? You know, do you need all of that increase in this next year to move forward with the projects that you have going on? Those are the kinds of questions.
So what options will the council have or the committee have once you've finished talking to the water company board?
Well, to be honest with you, Gabe, I haven't worked closely yet with the county attorney, you know, to get an opinion in what our options really are. You know, I know one of my colleagues has already introduced a resolution calling on them to rescind that proposed increase. So at this point, I can't tell you what our role is in that. I do know that, of course, any dividends that come back to the city, you know, we would have control over in working with the administration how to disperse those dividends at the end of the year. I'm not suggesting at all that, you know, we would return that money. I am suggesting, though, that, you know, asking the questions on the front end to figure out exactly what the need is and, you know, if the entire increase is warranted really is probably the more prudent thing to do at this point. And I don't think my committee members and I are not willing to, you know, to take a hard line and say, you know, based on the evidence you presented, and I'm looking forward to getting it, by the way, I've not made a decision yet, based on the evidence you presented, we are not convinced that you ought to move forward with this 5.5% increase. Therefore, you know, as a body, an official body formally, you know, we might begin to explore, you know, how we can move more slowly in accomplishing what the water company thinks they need to do. You know, I mean, I'm confident that and there are very fine public servants and employees at the water company. There's no doubt in my mind they would not be asking for this rate increase if they really didn't believe it was in the best interest of the water quality and the service of providing that water, that quality of water to our community. They don't just take their jobs for granted or lightly, and a rate, you know, a rate increase to their customers lightly. As a matter of fact, they bend over backwards to not do that in any significant fashion. So I'm looking forward to hearing their explanations and their defending their proposal, and I expect that we'll have a very good dialogue, and hoping that we can accomplish something we can agree to as a result of that dialogue.
So you're checking with the county attorney to find out what legally the council could do, if you could actually stop the increase, or if you could only kind of, I guess, I don't, for lack of a better word, scold the company.
Yeah, I mean, because what I've asked for is really what our options are, and, you know, without knowing or having that opinion back, and because of the holidays, I don't know that I will have it by our meeting on Monday, but I do anticipate it soon. You know, just to know what our options are. It is never my goal to be punitive, and it's never my goal to, you know, be threatening somebody or an agency if they don't do what we want them to do. I don't anticipate that's going to be the case now. I think that the water company officials will be cooperative partners with the Metro Council in doing what's best as we move forward. Not saying that it's going to be the easiest thing, but I really don't expect it to be hostile in any way. I think we're looking to find some answers, and I think that the water company is always good about providing those answers, and hopefully we will know more at the end of our meeting on Monday.
Does the council, you said the council can control how the money is spent once it comes in, or that you can vote on the budget?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So have you heard anything? Have you met any resistance from the water company? Have you heard anything from fellow council members or constituents about what's going
to
happen?
Well, to date, I may have personally, as I'm at the Kroger or the Heine Brothers on Frankfort Avenue, I've had a couple of people mention it to me. But to be honest with you, I've not had an outpouring of concern about this. And, you know, to some degree, I think it could be that, you know, when you look at if the average ratepayer is paying, you know, I think the increase, proposed increase, is $1.09 on the bill. So that if you're paying $18.89 now, you're going to be paying $20.09. You know, with this new increase, it could be that, you know, that maybe the water company is doing a good job educating the citizen, their customers, that the rate increase, while it sounds big, 5.5%, because that does mean a lot to people who are on fixed incomes, perhaps it's not as bad as we think. And so I haven't had at all in my office an outpouring of interest, although I did receive a copy of the Business First article from President King regarding the issue. So I know there is some interest, and of course Mr. Johnson's introduced the resolution. So I do know that there's some genuine interest, Mr. Heiner and I think Mr. Peden have reached out to make sure that we're going to have an opportunity to know more about this through our committee structure. So there's definitely interest, and so I think nobody really wants to judge yet, you know, what we're going to find out on Monday.
That was Gabe Bullard talking with Metro Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh about the Louisville Water Company's upcoming rate increase. When we come back, Stephanie Sanders reports on disappearing mailboxes in Louisville. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll learn more about an effort to bring more young professionals to Louisville. First, when's the last time you sent an email or paid a bill online? Now, how about the last time you sent a letter? This year, the U.S. Postal Service will deliver 8 billion fewer letters than it did 7 years ago. The sharp decline is why blue mailboxes are disappearing from America's postal landscape. Stephanie Sanders reports.
You might call this the loneliest mailbox in Louisville, but you wouldn't think so. It's really close to a busy intersection, right next door to a real estate office and a financial consulting group. There's a YMCA right across the street and a school just around the corner. And there are tons of people around. They're dropping off their kids, they're getting ready for work, they're doing errands for the day, but none of them are stopping at this bright blue mailbox. Tony Gorin is one person who does use this mailbox. He works next door at the real estate company and regularly drops off letters to his clients. He says the mailman always seems to have his hands full.
People stop there quite a bit. I'd say he's pulling out probably a good, you know, those little plastic bins that they use. He's probably pulling out a good full one of those every time he stops once a day.
During the 6 hours I watched this mailbox, the only person who approached it was the mailman, Robert Carter. Carter scrunches down, peers inside, and pulls out just two pieces of mail. In the 1960s and 70s, when these blue mailboxes were at their busiest, this collection box would average 200 pieces of mail a day. And this is why Louisville is doing away with one-third of its 900 mailboxes. Fewer people mailing letters means less money for the U.S. Postal Service, which lost $2.8 billion this year. David Walton with Louisville's Postal Service says in the declining economy, saving money is important.
You know, because of this decrease, and like many other private industries, we've been forced to become more efficient.
Walton says eliminating blue collection boxes means fewer miles postal workers have to drive, but officials have no idea how much money it might save. Other cities are also paring down their blue mailbox fleets. Last year, the post office eliminated almost 4,000 across the country. About 200,000 remain. National Postal Museum historian Nancy Pope says when blue mailboxes disappear, Americans lose part of their heritage.
You're taking something away that is part of their memory, part of their history, part of their community. And whether they use it on a regular basis or don't, when something is gone that used to be there, there is a pang there. There's a, you know, and the nostalgia that just hits in automatically.
Nostalgic or not, the Postal Service says in a time of economic distress and rapidly decreasing revenue, warm fuzzies can't trump the bottom line. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
President Bush visited Fort Campbell last week to welcome home members of the 101st Airborne Division from Iraq and Afghanistan. It was his last visit to the Army base as president. Joe Corcoran of Kentucky Public Radio was there for the visit and has this report.
The scene at Hangar 9 at the Fort Campbell Army Airfield Tuesday morning was part homecoming, part celebration at all good times. Nearly 8,000 soldiers and family members crammed into the hangar 2 hours before the president's arrival, entertained by the bluegrass group, the Grascals. Then, just after 10, the motorcade pulled up.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Despite historically low approval ratings and with just 2 months left in his 8-year term, the president got a rousing welcome before he began thanking the individual Fort Campbell units on base.
I am honored to be here at Fort Campbell. I'm honored to be with the Screaming Eagles of the 101st Airborne, the Night Stalkers of the 160th. Green Berets of the 5th Special Forces Group, all members of the Fort Campbell community. You are part of the finest military in the world.
Just in November alone, more than 10,000 soldiers have returned to Fort Campbell from Iraq and Afghanistan, many from their second or third tours of duty, and the president used the theme of Thanksgiving to praise them and their families.
In recent weeks, this post has been the scene of heartwarming family reunions. Many of you recently finished deployments to Iraq. You performed with courage and distinction on the front lines of the war on terror. You have returned on success. On behalf of a grateful nation, I'm proud to welcome home the Bastogne Brigade, the Strike Brigade, the Rokossan Brigade. Job well done. On behalf of an incredibly grateful nation, I extend our heartfelt thanks and our respect to the military families here on Fort Campbell.
The president recapped the successes of the troops in Iraq since the war began in 2003 and repeated his defense of sending tens of thousands of more troops into the country 3 years later, the controversial surge that he said changed the course of the war.
2006, our efforts were faltering. So I reviewed our strategy and changed course. Instead of retreating, I ordered more troops into Iraq. And to lead the surge, I chose a former commanding general of the 101st Airborne, the man formerly known as Eagle Six, General David Petraeus. Our troops conducted this surge with resolve and with valor. And nobody knows the impact better than the Screaming Eagles. When the Bastogne Brigade deployed to Saladin last year, the province was struggling to recover from the bombing of the famous Golden Mosque. But you partnered with the Iraqis to restore security. Schools and businesses are now open. The Golden Mosque is being rebuilt. And throughout the province, hope is returning. The terrorists are being driven out. The Iraqi people have the Screaming Eagles to thank. Across Iraq, the surge has produced similar results. Since the surge began, violence and sectarian killings have fallen dramatically. Iraqi security forces have taken responsibility for 13 out of Iraq's 18 provinces. Slowly but steadily, economic and political progress is taking place. Iraqis are working together for a more hopeful future.
The president singled out a couple of individuals for special thanks, Medal of Honor winner Don Jenkins of Butler County and Staff Sergeant Josh Forbus. Bush presented the Presidential Volunteer Service Award at the steps of Air Force One to Forbus for his longtime volunteer work at Fisher House. That's a place the families of injured soldiers stay for free to be near their loved one during recuperation. Forbus was seriously injured in a helicopter crash in Mosul in 2003. Since his recovery, he's led so-called wounded warrior meetings, and he serves as a mentor to combat injured veterans.
There's nothing really you can directly say to them at the same time or anything. You just try to relate somehow, you know? No matter how similar two injuries are, they're never going to be the same. Obviously, pain is a big thing. Some people's pain threshold is different other people's. But the main point I try to get across is you got to talk about it. You have to find somebody and talk about it, regardless if it's a guy on the street, you know, a close friend, a religious member, person. You know, you got to talk to somebody. You got to get it out. You know, volunteer service, you know, I do it because I love it. And then the fact that people recognize me and give me thanks and shake my hand, that's great. And then the fact that somebody actually nominated me for this award, you know, and then actually getting it from the president, I mean, it's an awesome feeling. It's indescribable, really. I can't put it into words, but, you know, I never really want, you know, I didn't get into it to try to win the Presidential Volunteer Service Award. I just wanted to give back. And, you know, the fact that it went all the way up so that the president recognized me and gave me this award, I mean, I'm speechless. I really am. It's in my heart, you know. That to me, that's what volunteer is. It's in your heart. It's what you love. And, you know, wounded soldiers and their families I love, obviously, because one, I am one, and two, I think that what I've been through I can help give back. But at the same time, you know, with the kids, you know, I mean, they're kids, like I said before, they're kids, and you can't help it. And as long as it's in your heart and it's the right thing to do and you're volunteering a lot of your time for the right reasons, it's a great thing.
The president wrapped up his talk to the troops by looking to the future. As conditions on the ground continue to improve, he said, he'll continue to reduce ground troops, a process he calls return on success. Already, a Marine Expeditionary Unit, 2 Marine battalions, and 6 Army brigades have been pulled out of Iraq without replacement, and the president promised another 4,000 troops would be sent home by the end of January, just as he leaves office. But he told the crowd there's still more work to be done.
War in Iraq is not over. But we're drawing closer to the day when our troops can come home. And when they come home, they will come home in victory. The work you have done and are going to do is historical work. You see, the consequences and success in Iraq will resonate far beyond that country's borders. And will resonate when your children and grandchildren begin to study the history of peace. Success will frustrate Iran's ambitions to dominate the region. Success will show millions across the Middle East that a future of liberty and democracy is possible. Success will deny al-Qaeda a safe haven for launching new attacks. Success in Iraq will mean that the American people are more secure at home.
Bush's speech was morale-boosting and politically one-sided, but speaking to troops as they exited the hangar, it seemed that's what they needed and wanted to hear from the president.
What did it mean for you for the president to be here today?
It meant a lot. I mean, knowing that this is going to be his last Thanksgiving as our commander-in-chief meant a lot to me. You know, get a chance to see him in person before he, his term is up. For me, it was a lot. The situation for my first deployment over there has changed dramatically. It's extremely safe and calm now compared to last time when I'm back in 2003. I mean, I gotta say, there's, I would say, 100% progress now compared to last time I was there.
It meant a lot, sir. It meant a whole lot. For the soldiers and that just come back, it meant great things to them, sir. Honestly, great things. From what I hear, it's getting better. It's not as bad as it was during OIF 1 or 2 when I was over there, but from what I understand, it's getting better.
Absolutely heartfelt words, and I think the response was the exact same.
For a lot of Fort Campbell soldiers and their families, Tuesday's visit by the president was a welcome home and a thanks for a job well done. For thousands of others, though, it was a send-off. They'll be deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan in the coming weeks.
How is the Louisville region faring when it comes to attracting and keeping talented young professionals? That was the focus of a recent summit in Louisville called Beyond Boundaries, Building Our 21st Century Community. It was co-sponsored by the local groups, the Bingham Fellows and Wired 65. One of the speakers at that event was Rebecca Ryan, the co-CEO of Next Generation Consulting, based in Madison, Wisconsin. She joined us for a phone conversation about the summit and young professionals.
The purpose of that event was to bring people together from a 26-county area, and we and TIP Strategies out of Austin, Texas, have been studying the area for the last several months to come up with strategies that the region can use to attract and retain workforce and grow workforce for 21st century jobs.
Well, what's your assessment of this area and region as a destination for these workers?
You bet. Well, a couple of things. The first piece to note is that we were really tasked with just focusing on my firm was focused with on just 20 to 40 year old knowledge workers. TIP really did most of the heavy lifting in terms of looking at the economy and thinking of ways that the economy could grow. But generally, I would say that the greater Louisville area, this 26 county area, it's got a lot of assets. However, in some cases for young professionals, what they value and their perception of the region aren't matching up. So, for example, when we work with a client, we focus on what we call our handprint. And this is a very simple spider diagram, and it measures a community in 7 attributes that the next generation values in a community. So if any of your listeners have ever heard Dr. Richard Florida or are familiar with the work around the creative class and how talent tends to cluster in cities, what we've done is we've taken the attributes of the city and sort of pulled them apart and said, here's what those cities offer that really attracts these younger knowledge workers. So in the case of the Louisville region, what we have is, for example, young professionals say that they value, first and foremost, having an affordable cost of lifestyle. However, their perception is that in some places you can afford to live, but in other places you can't afford to live. And more to the point, they say that when it comes to being able to find a good high-wage job, that's really difficult. For example, 93.6% of the young professionals we surveyed said that earning, being able to find a good job is very important to them. But their perception is that only 60% of them agree that they can find a good job in the region. So there are some areas where the perception and the reality aren't quite squaring up for the next generation.
For those who may not be familiar with the term, what is a knowledge worker?
Yeah, a knowledge worker. This is a term. It was coined, oh my gosh, clear back in 1959 by Peter Drucker. And at its most general, it's anybody who works with information on a day-to-day basis. So that's you, me, that's teachers, graphic designers, engineers, architects, about 30% of all workers in the United States are estimated to be knowledge workers, but here's where it gets really juicy. They command over 50% of the wages. So knowledge work jobs tend to generate more wealth in communities, and this is why a lot of regions, like the 26-county area and the Louisville area, are very interested in how do we attract and keep them.
What areas of the country kind of serve as models that Louisville, this area, could follow?
You bet. Well, first of all, I wouldn't limit it just to the United States. I think what we're starting to see is knowledge work clusters popping up across the world. But certainly Austin, Texas is one area that, 20 years ago didn't have a concentration of knowledge workers and really kind of reinvented itself. Denver, Colorado is another example of a community that Fortune magazine about 17 years ago said you can't get any lower than Denver, Colorado, but it too has managed to create sort of a knowledge-based hub there with their technology centers and their technology park. And then if you look even broader, Limerick, Ireland has done a great job. Ireland actually has a higher percentage of workers in knowledge-based jobs than even the United States does. So you see a lot of multinational companies right now, if they need English-speaking workers, Ireland is one of the first places that they stop.
That's really been booming over there in the last decade or so, hasn't it?
It really has. You know, when Dell was deciding where it was going to expand, it chose to go just outside of Dublin. And now Dell is the largest company, I believe, the largest exporter in Ireland.
Well, this current economy is tough on everyone, but how does it look specifically for the knowledge worker?
Well, it's interesting. I think, it's interesting. When you talk to community colleges and colleges, they always say, well, when the economy suffers, our enrollments go up. So it's one of the areas where, they tend to do well when there's a recession or a cutback in employment. And I think the good news for that is it sort of reinforces what we know, is that you are a little more recession-proof if you are in a knowledge-based job, because my dad's economy was one where he was rewarded for what he did with his hands. And in my economy, the economy I grew up with, I'm rewarded for what I can really do with my head. And that's the kind of value that economies, need to add. Of course, in the United States, we need, I know everybody says it's almost a cliche now, but we need more and more people with math and science skills. I'm concerned in some ways that we're sort of beating innovation out of our kids. When we start teaching what's on the test, we're forgetting all the things that aren't on the test, and that's where sort of the edges of innovation really lie. So I have some concerns about the United States, but I'm also inspired because I think some other countries, we've talked about a couple of them here, are really leapfrogging us and are showing that there is a way forward.
Rebecca Ryan with Next Generation Consulting. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
More information about Rebecca Ryan, knowledge workers, and the recent Beyond Boundaries Summit can be found at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Stephanie Sanders talks with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay about an easy Christmas gift that may bring you closer to your loved ones. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Tens of thousands of people across the country have participated in a radio project called StoryCorps. In a booth in Grand Central Station or in Airstream trailers outfitted as recording studios, pairs of people have gone inside to share stories about their lives. Those conversations have been recorded, preserved at the Library of Congress, and in some cases aired on National Public Radio. The stories are a Friday favorite on NPR's Morning Edition because they're sometimes funny, sometimes emotional, and always genuine. Something about the intimacy of that conversation makes for great radio and an ever greater preservation of that relationship. The founder of StoryCorps, Dave Isay, spoke with Stephanie Sanders about the project, the newly formed National Day of Listening, and how you can participate in the act of love known as listening.
Talk a little bit about what the National Day of Listening is. Is this the first year for it?
It is. Not only is it the first year, it's a very new idea, only a few weeks old. And this was kind of a direct response to the really difficult terrible turn that the economy has taken. And the idea of the National Day of Listening is that on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, we're asking the whole country to stop and take an hour out of the day and use any equipment they have available, whether it's an old cassette player or a video camera or a cell phone. Some cell phones can record audio, or your computer, and take an hour and honor someone in your life, honor an angel in your life, by listening to them and asking them about their lives and recording that. We look at this as kind of the least expensive but most meaningful gift you can give this holiday season. And, if you weren't able to do it on Friday, you can do it this week, next week, the week after. But the idea is really just to honor someone by listening to them, which is what StoryCorps is all about. Our mission is to honor and celebrate each other's lives through listening. And we're really excited to see how this goes this year.
And I would imagine people who have participated in StoryCorps across the country, I'm sure, are already sold on this idea and have been spreading it to their families and friends, and I guess just kind of spreading the word about what an interesting and effective way this is to get to know people who are right next to you every day of your life.
Yeah, the microphone really gives you the license to have conversations that you don't have every day. And no matter how well you think you know this relative who you're interviewing, I guarantee you when you have a microphone and you've done some preparation, we have this website, nationaldayoflistening.org, that gives you all the information you need and has something called a question generator with what we found to be the best questions, the questions that work really well in interviews, and scores of other questions, and the best questions of all, which are the questions you really want to ask. We have places where you can fill in your own questions and kind of reorder that list. I guarantee you that when you sit down with a loved one and ask them questions, that you are going to learn something that you never knew before, no matter how well you think you know them. It's a really amazing experience, and that's money-back guarantee. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the word has spread. We thought of this, this is only a couple weeks old, and we thought of this as a pilot project, and it's just snowballed. Last week, the President and Mrs. Bush were interviewed by President Bush's sister, Doro, and of course, all over, you hear about National Day of Listening all over public radio, and our website keeps shutting down under all the traffic that's been coming to us, although we've got that under control, so you can now visit safely. But I've been really blown away by the response, and it's not just the 25,000 people. Well, it's actually 50,000 people who've participated in StoryCorps. We've done about 25,000 interviews, and people come in pairs, but all kinds of people from all walks of life who connect to this really simple idea. And again, it is in these tough times, these interviews really remind us what's really important and who's really important and how lucky we are to be alive.
And you mentioned some of the pieces we've been hearing on public radio throughout the week. That kind of brings up one of the other things that I love about this is, it can be someone that you're extremely close to, like Steve Inskeep interviewed his mother, but it can also be someone, that you just see in your neighborhood or who maybe you smile at every day on the street, but you don't know their name. And then you
that's
just stop
exactly
and
right.
say, hey, let's have a conversation.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the most kind of beautiful uses of StoryCorps. For, if people don't have family around or would rather, interview other folks, and again, this isn't just for Thanksgiving. You can do this anytime, certainly around the holiday season. We suggest take a tape recorder or a video camera and go to a local soup kitchen or go to a senior center and ask the director there if it's okay to do an interview and, honor the folks in there by listening to them.
That was Dave Isay talking with Stephanie Sanders. Learn more about the National Day of Listening and StoryCorps at our website, WFPL.org. From there, you can also find out more about the book of stories from StoryCorps called Listening as an Act of Love. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.